I've made no secret of my love for heavy metal. I've listened to metal for most of my life. When people realize this about me, the obvious question is, well, then why don't I play heavy metal? The answer is twofold. Truthfully, I don't have the chops to play metal properly. My guitar playing is limited, my vocal range is limited, and my knowledge in music theory has just about flatlined. So, I'm very content to be relegated to the happy-go-lucky world of rock and roll. It's a station I accept gladly. Rock and roll is a much more forgiving master, not as strict and rigid as heavy metal's high standards. Although I'm not an idiot, I know all it would take would be for me to buckle down and concentrate on my chops a little bit more, and I'm sure I could beef up my guitar and vocal abilities. But that leads me to the second reason why. I simply don't want to. Being in this music biz for 19 years, a lot of what held mystery and intrigue for me has long been soiled. In a deliberate attempt to hold on to these innocent, wide-eyed feelings that attracted me to the music in the first place, I refuse to decode metal. I refuse to get too close to it, choosing to enjoy it from afar, standing in awe of it the same way my jaw dropped when I first heard Black Sabbath's Iron Man or Metallica's Battery. I don't want to master it. I want to worship it. And so, my life has been a constant tug of war. For as much as I love and appreciate the raw caterwaul sounds of primitive garage rock with its amateur aesthetics, I equally enjoy the virtuosic skills of metal's top players, namely guitarists, or to put it more bluntly, shredders. I love watching a shredder take aim and, with the skill of a sniper and the speed of a bullet, hit all their marks before one can take a breath in. It can be argued that it's simple gymnastics, void of any real creativity and inspiration, but then why is it so exhilarating to watch? Since I was a kid and heard Eddie Van Halen's Eruption, the guitar solo has held so much mystical sway for me, and I was immediately indoctrinated into the cult of the guitar hero, people like Tony McAlpine, Jakey Lee, Randy Rhoads, George Lynch, Warren DeMartini, Joe Satriani, Greg Howe, Steve Vai, Paul Gilbert, Jason Becker, and of course, Marty Friedman, were like modern-day wizards to me, wielding their axes to make impossible sounds effortlessly. It's the reason why all Jeff Waters and Marty Friedman had to do was ask, and I was right there, singing on Annihilator tracks and Marty's Inferno album. It was an honor to lay anything musical alongside these guys I consider to be masters. But as things go in cycles, the guitar solo went out of fashion, especially when Nirvana took over and a more punk aesthetic cascaded across the land until it reached its boiling point on Metallica's Saint Anger, an album devoid of guitar solos, when the biggest metal band in the land opted to not use one of their greatest assets, that being the Kirk Hammett guitar solo, the pendulum had swung its full 180 degrees. But that was 13 years ago, and all indicators seem to be once again favoring an emphasis on guitar artistry when listening to people like Tosin Abasi, Marnie Stern, John Five, Bumblefoot, Michael Amott, Richard Fortus, Jeff Loomis, and now add Nita Strauss to that list. Nita Strauss is the lead guitarist in the Alice Cooper band, but that's only where the story begins. Her CV reads like a carnival ride through the world of music, from deathcore bands to playing in Critical Hit with Jason Hayes, Jermaine Jackson's touring outfit, playing in Femme Fatale and the Iron Maidens with guitarist Courtney Cox, to playing in the Los Angeles Kiss house band for Gene and Paul's AFL Arena Football League team. Nita has almost done it all. Now, since enlisting in Alice's band, she joins an elite group of musicians whose pedigree includes Michael Bruce and Glenn Buxton, Dick Wagner and Steve Hunter, Ryan Roxy and Tommy Henriksen, Reb Beach, Orianthe Panagaris, Kerry Kelly, Davy Johnstone, Steph Burns, and Kane Roberts. I discovered her over a year ago while in the studio laying down guitars for our new album, Fire Music. It was inspiring to see her play, knowing that there were new shredders out there on the scene to watch, than my usual go-to list while I laid down my blues box paint-by-numbers guitar solos. Alice Cooper is currently on tour with Motley Crue, as Crue wrap up their farewell tour. And when they hit Toronto this past August, I met up with Nita to chat. I want to thank Josh Villalta for helping set up this podcast, and of course Nita for being very welcoming, despite some tech problems on my end. It was a Murphy's Law moment before I started recording this episode, but I managed to get it all together. I also want to thank Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones for supporting this podcast. And this podcast supports Chino Loco's restaurants because when I want a fish burrito, I want it stuffed with chow mein noodles. Thank you for listening and possibly subscribing to this podcast on either iTunes or SoundCloud. If you haven't subscribed yet, it's free, so please do so. Nita Strauss is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. Tell him for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang do. When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
So, Nita, thank you for having me at your place in my city.
Welcome to my place. Welcome to my temporary home away from home.
You are currently on tour with Motley.
That's right.
And I think it was even last August, the tour came in to Toronto.
That's right. We did the beer place. What's the outside? Molson Amphitheater. Yeah. That was awesome. It was actually my first time there and I loved it. It was a really, really beautiful venue.
We were in town. But we were holed up in the recording studio. Ugh. So the funny thing is it was around that time I was like, around this time we were mastering. But before then, a few months before, it was guitars, and I had to do solos and stuff. And I was checking your videos out for inspiration. Yeah, I was.
Wow. Thank you so much.
And we're gonna do. I got to take a photo with you. I'm gonna send it to Eric Ratz, our producer,
okay.
Because, you know, we were talking about your. There's this one video of you, where you did it yourself. You took the video yourself, and then you smile at the camera, and then you rip into this like solo that's insane.
It has to be the one where I was like in my old apartment, like sitting at the computer in my old apartment. The funny thing about that video is because I did it on. What's it called? Photo booth on the computer. And I had never made a video of myself playing before. And everyone goes, oh, you're left-handed? Because it switched. The video flipped around.
Oh, okay.
And they go, oh, yeah. And then people that know I'm not left-handed go, well, you should really invest in a better camera, Nita. You should really invest in better equipment if you're going to be making videos of yourself. I said, you know what? Just for that, I'm not going to make any more videos of myself. You guys are just going to have to watch the real videos, the real live videos. See, you really just can't please everybody, can you?
No.
You can't.
Well, first we checked out that, and we were checking out. There's also a very popular, well-known video of you and Courtney Cox at the NAMM show trading off.
The funniest part of that video, I think, is the the guy at the beginning with like, I think it must be the guy holding the camera or something. But you hear the guy every time I see that video, I always die laughing. He's going, oh, like making these hilarious noises.
Really?
Oh yeah. You got it. Like next time you go, if you type in the Iron Maiden's NAMM 2012 or whatever that was, I don't even know what year it was. But that's the funniest part of that video for me is this guy at the beginning. You don't know what's going on.
Well, last year was like you had just joined Alice's band, right?
That's right, yeah.
So I think it was June. So we were in the studio making this record, and I think started to check out your videos, and then news came like, you know that girl we were watching like a couple days ago? She just got the gig for Alice Cooper, man. So we were really keeping abreast of what you were doing. And then I think what started me following you on Instagram was that you posted, I saw it in my search engine because I guess we have mutual Instagram friends.
Yeah.
It was just a picture of your iPhone or your smartphone device listening to Inferno by Marty Friedman.
Oh my God. I'm a huge, huge Marty Friedman fan. And I do love that new album, but I love everything he's ever done. I even like the mellow stuff, like Scenes.
I would like to say thank you.
Yes. So, you know, nobody cares about nobody seems to really give Marty Friedman's chill stuff enough credit, you know, Tibet and like these really great, you know, relaxing songs. They're masterpieces. I even like Tokyo Jukebox, if you've ever heard that album. It's so
absolutely
catchy.
Absolutely. And I'm on 3 tracks on Inferno.
I did know that.
I was singing on that, and then there's a Japanese import that's going to be released soon with the 3rd song.
That I didn't. Yeah, I knew you were on the album. I didn't know how many tracks it was, but very, very cool.
Yeah, and that was just so I figured, that's like an in. So I that's how I was like, wow, who's listening to Inferno? And I'm like, oh my God, it's Nita Strauss. Then I started to follow you on Instagram and. And Marty's someone who's been on the podcast before, and the one commonality between me and Marty in that we became good friends very fast was our mutual love for Kiss.
Right.
This podcast moonlights as a Kiss podcast whenever Marty comes on the podcast.
That's awesome.
So my question to you, and I know you know where I'm going with this, is... Mm-hmm. If I have the story right, you were basically discovered by Alice's people through Kiss in a roundabout way.
In a very roundabout way, kind of, sort of, yes. When Shep Gordon first found out about me and asked, what can I see of this girl? And they said, what do you want to send him? I thought about it. I said, well, he probably doesn't want to hear me playing Maiden songs. You know, I could send him some shred shit that I've done, but nobody really wants to hear that. You know, like, it's not really an Alice thing. So I thought, what better thing to show him than me playing the national anthem at an arena football game? And that, of course, was when I was playing for the LA Kiss, the team that is owned by Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. So I sent him a video of me playing the national anthem, and that was what prompted him to say, okay, I want to meet this girl.
So it wasn't someone in the Alice camp, like in the stands, going, let's catch a football game with Gene and Paul.
No, that was the home opener. That was the first game ever. And they didn't have anyone to sing the national anthem. You know, I was already going to be playing at the game doing like some in-game, you know, kind of just entertainment stuff. And Harlan Hendrickson, who is the sort of entertainment director, mastermind of the LA Kiss extravaganza.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to call it a football game so much as a huge extravaganza. He said, look, he called me up. He said, do you know anybody that can sing the national anthem? You know, we're kind of looking for a name, but, you know, we tried to get Slash. We tried to get this and that. I said, please let me do it. Like, I was like, I will not charge you anything else, which is probably what got it for me. I said, I'll do it for free. I'll never do it again, but just like, please just let me do it one time. I'm a big sports fan, big NFL fan, and I just always thought it would be so cool to play the national anthem at a football game. So I got to do it, and in doing that, it ended up opening up an amazing door for me.
So can we backtrack here? How did you even get the gig for the LA Kiss football team? That in itself, the idea of Kiss owning a football team and naming it after themselves.
What else
would
they name
it? I know. Love guns. No. How did that even come about? And you're obviously a Kiss fan.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to be in rock music today and not be a Kiss fan. You know, I was on that metal show not that long ago, and Ace was on the same show as I was, and I had to play guitar right in front of him. And I don't think I have ever, you know, my boyfriend said to me, he's like, I've never seen you nervous like that. I don't really get nervous. You know, we Grass Pop, these huge festivals, which of course we both have done this year. I didn't really get nervous, but, you know, looking there and seeing Ace Frehley sitting there looking at me going, okay, impress me. I was like, ooh.
If I remember that episode correctly, quickly. He was like, he was pretty much on fire. I mean, he was cracking the whole panel up.
Yeah, he was funny, witty. You know, he's a little spacey, but I think that's just Ace. That's Space Ace.
It's Ace.
You know, he brought a new meaning to Space Ace that day. Yeah. That's for sure. But it was just, I mean, him and Mark Farner, it was just so crazy.
Yeah, he was an interesting cat as well. Like someone I didn't expect to be like that.
Me either.
Yeah, he was kind of like a hippie.
Yeah,
right?
Well, I thought it was funny when he was like, they said, what's your advice? He's like, women.
I was like, whoa.
Okay. He just went right out there and said it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and of course, I did my audition process for the Alice Cooper Band with Shep Gordon and Bob Ezrin.
Shep Gordon, the manager of Alice Cooper.
Yeah, long manager Alice, 45 years, I think, now or something. He's got a great documentary out called Supermensch, if you guys haven't seen that. It's so good. But Ezrin was really like, you know, I met them at a really swanky hotel in L.A., and I walked in. I was like, that's the guy that made Destroyer. Like, that's the guy, you know, of course, Pink Floyd and, you know, and all the early Alice stuff and all of Ezrin's accomplishments. But all I could think about was, oh, my God, Destroyer. Destroyer.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but did I see Bob Ezrin in the lobby before I got up here? Is he on the tour?
He's not on the tour. He might be here. If he's here, I didn't know that. He doesn't live in Canada. I know that, but he could very well be here. It wouldn't surprise me if he was here. If he is, nobody told me.
Maybe it's just, I just like maybe being in the lobby, knowing who's here, and I just have my radar up.
Projecting.
Yeah, you're like, oh,
that's Bob Ezrin. That's your tour manager.
Yeah, exactly.
It would be really a treat to see Ezrin here. I don't think he's seen the show in quite a while, and the show's really evolved. You know, Shep and Bob were very instrumental when I first joined the band. They were very instrumental in, you know, sort of building the show, letting me know what parts to come out and grab some spotlight, what parts to sit back and let Coop really do Coop, you know. And the whole sound of the band is very carefully constructed. So I would love the chance to show Ezrin how far it's come since last year when we first started doing this, when I first started doing it.
And that's another thing I wanted to ask is, though there is another thread between Alice and Kiss through Ezrin, you were with LA Kiss. Mm-hmm. Was there any connection between you being with the Kiss camp in a way and then bridging over to Alice?
No, you know, none whatsoever, which is so funny. It's such a small world, such a small musical world. You know, like, of course, we're out with Motley Crue. They've got a lot of Kiss's crew out.
Doc McGee.
Yeah.
Kind of connection.
Yeah, well, they've got a lot of their road crew. You know, a lot of the riggers and sound people have also done Kiss. And, you know, their front of house guy was with Kiss for years and, you know, all this stuff. So it's a very, like, tight-knit, close group. Actually, I don't remember who it was, but when I was there and met Shep and Bob for the first time, I think it was Bob that said to Shep, have you seen this video of her playing the national anthem? And Shep said, no. And they watched it right there in front of me. And I was just sort of sitting there in the hotel room like, oh, I'm glad I know I did this good. Like, I'm glad I know it was a good video, because if I wasn't sure what video it was, I would have just been, like, terrified.
Right.
But Bob is such a cool person to work with. He's very exacting, knows exactly what he wants, knows, you know, and he's very not shy about telling you what it is that he wants. During, you know, during my audition process, it was very like,
it can be very intimidating.
Oh yeah, it's very, very, very intimidating. But I'm a perfectionist too. I understand what it's like to work with a perfectionist. So, you know, the real trick for me with that whole process was not getting offended, not saying, okay, it's not like he doesn't like me. It's just that what I'm playing is not right for what they want, you know. So I have to figure out how to not get bummed out, not, you know, because we're guitar players, we're sensitive, you know. So what do you mean that's not what you want? This is me. This is my only way of communicating.
And I mean, as a guitar player, you identify as a shredder.
Yeah.
You're a shredder in that classic sense.
That's so funny. There's this story I've told a couple times, and Ezrin called me up and woke me up like really early in the morning. And he asked me if I thought, he said, do you think you're a rock guitar player? And I said, yes, sir, I do. He's like, you're not. You're a shredder.
And I kind of know what he means by that.
Yeah, I know. I completely know what he means. And he said, if you're given the chance to be in the Alice Cooper band, could you become a rock guitar player in time? And I said, yes. Yes, sir, I could. And actually, I took my very first guitar lesson in my whole life that day. I was like, okay, I went to a teacher in L.A., you know, I asked around, found the best rock guy. Oh, well, I mean, that guy would be great. I don't think he lives in L.A. anymore. No, it was a great teacher named Bill LaFleur, and I went over, you know, he was at GIT, at Musicians Institute for many years, and I went over to his apartment, and I said, I need some licks, dude. Like, you got to give me some licks, man. I need some rock licks. And really just took me to the blues school, you know, real classic stuff, you know, and I had to throw all the Malmsteen and Vai and John Petrucci and string skipping and all this stuff out the window and really just go to basics. It was awesome. It was a great education.
Yeah, it's interesting because I identify as a rhythm guitar player. I can't solo out of my balls if I can't solo to save my life. So, you know, I do understand the difference between the shredding and the rock guitar playing.
Yeah.
Do you consider rock guitar playing to be a little more messier?
Well, I mean, you look at guys like Hendrix and Jimmy Page and stuff. They're not the cleanest guitar players, you know. They're sloppy. But not in a bad way. You know, it's. I think rock guitar playing is an elusive art. You know, anybody can shred. Anybody can sit down and get a metronome and drill. You know, the same runs and scales until you can play them fast. Shredding is easy. You know, rock guitar playing is not easy. You really have to feel it. It has to come from somewhere. And that was something because I am one of those guitar players that can fall into a pattern of being very mechanical. I can just go, oh, I can play fast, so that's it. You know, I got some speed at a younger age, and I just, I'll just do something fast. I default to fast. And to really play something that comes from the heart, that takes effort, that takes time. So people go, oh, the rock stuff's easy. The rock stuff is not easy to do well, you know? It's really not.
It's a very cliched, very almost cheesy way to describe, but like it is true. You got to play with your soul and your heart.
Absolutely.
And you know, but the funny thing is the whole kind of shredding, for lack of a better term, like shrapnel way of doing things, like that whole Mike Varney went out of vogue. Yeah, but it went out of vogue. I'm very interested to know how you got into that whole kind of scene when it was out of vogue. I'm assuming.
Out of vogue. Yeah, I think, you know, I was born at the end of 86. So by the time I started playing guitar, I started playing guitar in 2000. And so it was totally uncool.
That was just not happening.
It's completely
then.
Uncool. But I started playing guitar after seeing the movie Crossroads, seeing Steve Vai do that amazing scene at the end of the movie. Just every guitar player listening to this right now goes, oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
100 to 200 times.
1,000 times. Yeah. 100 to 200,000. Like, you know, yeah, I just...
The question is, which side did you pick? Which guy do you pretend to be?
Oh, Vai. I still pretend to be Vai in Crossroads every day.
I pretend to be Macchio.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, that's
or
so Rye interesting.
Cooter,
yeah, Rye Cooter. Yeah, to this day, I will always maintain... I spend every minute of every day just trying to get to the level of coolness that Steve Vai was in Crossroads. Like,
he was
so cool. Like, he was so cool. Like, I remember, you know, I had a guitar. I didn't really play it back then. And I remember just sitting and watching that movie, and I was just, like, thinking, what? How come nobody told me you could do something that cool with a guitar? I had a little Squire, like, you know, like, couldn't do anything like that.
Too.
Yeah, a little black and white Squire. First thing I did was take off the white scratch plate and put a black one on. Even back then, always customizing my stuff. But yeah, I mean, it's crazy. And that movie just holds up. You know, I showed it to my boyfriend. It is a drummer. He'd never seen it. And I was interested to see how it would translate from a guitar player's perspective, you know, to another musician's. And he was just as enthralled by it as I was. It was so cool to see somebody as affected by it. You know, it really showed me it's a universal thing. It's not like, oh, I'm a guitar player and that's Vai and Vai's cool. Like, it was, wow, this is a really story of good and evil. And,
well,
and
he was acting to a certain degree in that movie as well. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't just a guitar player.
Not yeah.
Any guy could have gone up there.
Yeah, any guy could have gone up there. And the infuriating thing about that movie, of course, is that Vai just messes up on the easy part at the end. Like, he play all the other stuff and he can't do the bends. Like,
yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, bends. He just
oh, it's too much.
But we did a video about, what was it, 5 years back, mm-hmm. with a guest star, Ralph Macchio, guest starred in our video. Yeah.
Oh, cool. I have to check that out.
And during the day, you know, we would give him his space. We would just like let him be on his own. We didn't want to bug him or anything, but he came to us. He kept coming up to us going, hey guys, so how is it like being in a band? And, and like, do you guys know Karate Kid? And, yeah. And we all said, well, we like Karate Kid, but it's Crossroads. He goes, of course, Crossroads. That's why, you know, that's the connection. And he goes, when his son was learning to play guitar, he has that guitar at home from the movie.
Oh, wow.
And his son brought it to his guitar teacher to play, to get a lesson.
Wow.
And all the teachers, wherever he was, all gathered around the guitar. Everyone was making up. So it is a big deal. The Crossroads did really hit a lot of people in more ways than I think the movie makers even knew.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I mean, it was a good movie. It wasn't great, you know, you know, we were actually just talking about on the tour bus because the guys play these relict guitars, you know, these relict Gibson guitars, and they got these new ones. I looked at Tommy Henriksen, our guitar player. I said, I bet you saw that in the store window and you just bought it because you thought it looked beat up. Like, Lightning Boy. Yeah. You know, like, just, it's classic. It's a classic movie. And, you know, maybe it's like Spinal Tap. You know, I wonder if those guys really knew how much that movie would stand the test of time. Man, you know, you're a touring musician. You know that movie is very true to life.
Yeah, I think every musician who goes on tour, who goes through something that was similar to the movie, just quotes that part of the movie.
Awesome. Yeah.
You know, whether you can't find the stage or, you know.
Yeah, I don't know how many cities I've said hello Cleveland in.
Yeah, exactly.
We did this gig at the end of the last tour. Every once in a while, you know, you throw in off day shows or whatever, and sometimes they're cool, sometimes they're like less cool. And we played at this casino. And it was us, and then I think the next day was a comedian, a Spanish language comedian named Polo Polo. And I looked at the guys, I was like, if I told them once, I've told them 1,000 times. It's Alice Cooper, then Polo Polo.
Right, of course, right.
It's Spinal Tap, then Puppet Show.
Yeah, exactly.
It's funny, man. Being in a band's funny.
Yeah. This isn't the first full-on touring band. You were in the Iron Maidens, mm-hmm. but you were also... Maybe I'm wrong, but did you get your real pro start playing guitar with Jermaine Jackson?
I would call that my pro start, yeah.
That is quite an interesting
different
point on a resume
for
a rock guitar.
It is, you know, and the funny thing is, you know, I had done tours before then. I had done tours, you know, Warped Tour and this and that with all my local bands. You know, I played in, you know, toured with a deathcore band called As Blood Runs Black. Like, I had this sort of, like, very, like... heavy background.
Is that your passion as well?
Playing metal. I love playing metal. I do, you know, and I can't help it. And the album I'm writing now, I'm working on a solo album, and it's so heavy. And every once in a while, I take a step back and look at it, and I go, people aren't gonna like this. Like, I mean, people are gonna like it, but you know, a part of me thinks I should make a rock record that Alice Cooper fans will appreciate. I'm 28. Maybe I should make a rock record and do the heavy record later. But I have to make the record that's in my heart.
Right.
I have to make the record, and the record that's in my heart is very evil. Like, you know, and it's just that's what's coming out. So it's funny because that's my background is playing thrash and death metal and black metal and stuff. So I got the call in 2010, fresh off the As Blood Runs Black tour, and they said, can you play funk? And I said, yeah, like, you know, because my MO is always just say yes and figure it out.
Right.
You know, you're not going to ever get a gig if you go, well, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, I've never done it before, but I'm sure if I have a couple weeks, I could get there. It's like, they're going to be like, okay, forget it. We'll find somebody who can do it. So they say, can you play funk? I said, yeah, of course. Absolutely I can. With this sort of like very limited, like Santa Monica, which is where I'm from, California idea of what funk was, which is nothing. It's no idea. So I got in there, you know, I auditioned and got the gig. And then the other guitar player was Mike Scott, who's played with Justin Timberlake, Prince, you know, the funkiest guy on the planet. And I realized very quickly that Mike Scott can play more with one note on one string than I can play with all the scales I know. Like all the runs and scales and sweeps and, you know, Nuno Bettencourt kind of slides and stuff. None of that was cool in this camp. Like, they're like, oh, yeah, cool. Just play the part. Just do it as it's written.
Right.
And so that was a really big eye opener for me. That was a moment where I was like, maybe playing fast, light bulb, maybe playing fast isn't everything. Who knew? Right. No one told me.
What's your name on that?
He was lovely to me. He was really, you know, I've heard all kinds of stories about working with the Jacksons, working with the Jackson family, and we had Tito and Randy in and out of the rehearsal room, you know, during tour prep for that, and they were never anything but perfectly lovely with me. You know, I was the only one that didn't know anybody. I was the only girl in the band. I was the youngest one by 20, 30 years, and everyone just really embraced me. Everyone was very, very cool. And I mean, working with, you know, Jonathan Moffitt playing drums, you know, and musical directing, like it was such an experience. I didn't even really understand fully at the time what I was getting myself into. And then now I look back, I go, wow, I was playing with some pretty cool people back then.
There's a really interesting thing where, like, to the layperson, some of these names you're throwing out doesn't mean anything. But then there's a second tier of fandom where it's like guys, jobbers,
yeah,
are celebrities amongst themselves in a certain area of the music industry.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's like Nuno Bettencourt's and Richard Fortus's.
Oh, yeah.
They're like
gods.
Yeah, to a lot of people.
Yeah, and
drummers are like, that's another scene unto itself.
Yeah, well, our drummer Glenn Sobel is one of those guys. Like, he's been around the hired gun scene for so many years, and it's just a fantastic drummer.
You know, when we played together at Grass Pop, mm-hmm, a couple months ago, I was in the crowd. I saw the set.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I was there. I watched the whole set. Wow. And all I was looking at was that drummer guy going, yeah, who the fuck is that dude, man?
Glenn Sobel is really a force of nature, force to be reckoned with. Glenn, he's a great drummer. I've known who he was. You know, we're both from LA. We're both LA born and bred, Glenn and I. So I've known who he was from the scene just for years. I didn't even know his last name was pronounced Sobel. I thought it was pronounced Sobel. And I've known who Glenn was since I thought his name was Glenn Sobel. And I was like, oh, I'm in a band with Glenn Sobel. That's so cool. Like, you know, and that's the crazy thing about being in this Alice Cooper band. You know, Chuck, of course, Chuck Garrick, our bass player, was in Dio. You know, Ryan Roxy, I used to have a picture of Ryan Roxy on my wall next to my picture of Jason Becker, you know, like when I was a young guitar player growing up. So it's kind of crazy looking, you know, and of course Alice has had this phenomenal guitar player, you know, the guitar list of guitar players in this band, you know, and you know, Al Petrelli and Red Beach and Steve Hunter and Dick Wagner, Kane Roberts, and it's just so crazy to look at that list and see my name on it. Like, still,
that's the thing. When we heard, or I read, or I found out somehow that you had gotten the gig, it's like, well, now she's just part of this lineage that comes automatically with this starter kit of like, okay, you're automatically gonna be known forever.
Yeah, what a great honor that is.
And I don't know if we went through this, but how did you get the Alice Cooper gig? Okay, you sent in the videotape of you at the LA Kiss show.
They asked what they could see of me playing. And then I went and met them. Once I met up with them, we just really hit it off well. Shep and Bob and myself just got along. We laughed and talked, you know, talked business, talked music a little bit. And then they sent me some tracks to play over. They sent me some audition tracks, which Bob immediately tore to pieces. And just said, he just called me up. You know, I sent them in. I managed to send them in. He called me within 10 minutes, two songs. So I don't even know if you listened to it all the way through. He called me within 10 minutes. So this is not what we're looking for at all. Like, I think his exact words were, can you do anything else? So no, you know.
So intimidating.
Yeah, but now that I look back on those early auditions, I realize I was so in the show-off mindset, you know, because when we had spoken, they said, we really want someone that has a big presence, that can take over the stage, that can, you know, be a big part of the show, and I was very confident. And I was like, okay, I got this. I was playing upside down, doing all kinds of crazy tricks, and this is just so not what the Alice Cooper band is all about. I was like, what?
I would have gone with the same approach if I was you.
Yeah, well, you know, you got to show them what you can do.
Yeah,
and now they know, and then you go back and you do the simple stuff, and it was ended up being, you know, the rock stuff. And I think before I did end up getting the gig, they probably still had some reservations about that. But the thing is, just show me what to play, and I'll play it. You know, tell me to go off and go nuts, I'll go off and go nuts. If you show me exactly what to play, I'll play exactly that. So yeah, that's, I think, and that's a big part of the hired gun, quote unquote, idea, I think, is to not step all over the song and not, you know, really just give the song its own space. And that's not easy.
Yeah, I'm sorry for using the term hired gun.
That's exactly what it is.
It could be viewed as a kind of a derogatory term for people, but there is a star system within that.
I don't think it's a negative thing at all. I was actually just in a documentary called Hired Gun, you know, and it's, you know, it's what it is. It's, I don't think there's any shame in being a hired musician, which a lot of people are like, oh, well, you're not a real band member. You're not a real this and that. It's like, well, first of all, there are no real band members in this band. You know, the band is Alice Cooper. It has always been Alice Cooper, and it will always be Alice Cooper. I'm just so thankful to get the chance to play, you know, I don't care what they call me. I get to play with Alice Cooper.
And how was Alice like during this whole process of you joining?
He was great. You know, I met him when he was in the studio working on the Hollywood Vampires record, which is, I think, is just about to come out. And he was just totally, totally cool, very welcoming, very receptive. You know, it's interesting now. I hear him do interviews. He goes, yeah, we really wanted a shredder. You know, we wanted a shredder to come in. I was like, okay. But that's what they got, you know, and it's been so well received, you know. And obviously, you know, he had Orianthi in the band before me, and she's got her own built-in fan base. And I had a lot of people to win over, you know, and a lot of rock fans are not so much into the kind of over-the-top style of playing that I do. And, you know, not everyone's going to like it, but I think most of them have come over now.
Well, I mean, I wasn't able to catch you last year with Motley, but I did see you a couple months ago, and it was a spectacular show. It was amazing. Okay, so as I said before, this is this podcast, Moonlights, is a Kiss podcast. So I had to ask you one more question, which is, what were your dealings? Like Kiss and Gene and Paul? How's Paul Stanley? What's that whole world like?
You know, the guys, you know, I wish I had better stories. They honestly weren't around much. You know, they got there at game time. They left just after game time. But the coolest story, I will tell you this, the coolest moment that I had with them of all, because I had to leave the LA Kiss season early to come on the Alice Cooper tour. And I really, you know, from the time that I got this phone call to send Shep a video, and to the first day of the tour was about 2.5-3 weeks. So it wasn't like there was a long, you know, a long window of time. So I sort of had to leave them in the lurch. I found another guitar player. I had Courtney Cox from the Iron Maidens come in and do the rest of the season.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I got my best friend to do it. You know, what else are you going to do? But I had to make the tough call and say, look, I'm sorry, I can't fulfill my commitment to you guys. And they were very, very cool about it. And I was leaving the stadium on my last day. I was leaving the arena, and Paul was walking his car. I was walking in my car. I said, "See, Paul," you know. And then he stopped, and he actually turned around and walked back, which I thought was so cool. He didn't have to walk out of his way. And he shook my hand. He looked me right in the eye and said, "I heard we're gonna lose you after today. We're really bummed." He goes, "But if we have to lose you to anybody, I'm really happy. It's to the Alice Cooper camp. They're great people, and you're gonna have a great time."
Wow.
I was like, I was so touched. I actually, like, I was like, I had tears in my eyes. I was like, wow, that is so nice of him. He did not have to do that. No. You know, like, there was nothing, you know, there was no, and this wasn't in front of anybody. This wasn't, you know, this was just like a truly genuine moment from one person to another saying, we're sorry to lose you, but we're happy. If we have to lose you to anybody, we're glad it's to the Alice Cooper band. I'm like a little happy thinking about it now, like a little, you know, what a cool thing. I didn't even know if they knew who I was, you know, like, of course, they approved me to, you know, to do the thing, but it was just a really cool moment.
Well, I mean, out of all the original members, there's a lot of people who are, you know, on Ace's team, Gene's team. I've always said I'm Team Paul.
Team Stanley.
I'm Team Stanley. He's favorited two of my tweets.
Yay!
He answered one of my questions on Twitter.
That's amazing.
So
I love that new. Ibanez just came out with a reissue of the Paul Stanley signature guitar, the mirror guitar.
Isn't it a wash?
It's an Ibanez.
Oh.
The new one. They brought it back from the old school one. They just reissued it. It is so cool. The cracked mirror guitar. Oh man, it's cool looking.
I would just have it just to have.
Oh, I want one so bad. I want one so bad. They're really, really cool looking, these things.
That's great. Well, thank you very much, Nita. I know you got to go to sound check and go to the venue and do your thing with Motley Crue. And how has Motley Crue been on this whole year of touring with them?
They've been so great. They've been so welcoming. Their whole crew has been great. The band members have been awesome.
I love Nicki, man.
Yeah, Nicky, I think, spends more time in our dressing room than his own. You know, always swapping war stories and.
And you just listen in on
the he's a great dude. Yeah, he's really, really. All of them have been really, really cool with us. All of them have been very. You know, there's no. Between them and us, there's no opening band, support band ego, you know, which would be very easy. It's their last tour, you know, it'd be easy. But these, they also have a tremendous amount of respect for Alice, you know, and
there would be no crew.
Yeah.
Or Kiss.
Or, yeah, I mean, he really, you know, and that's the funny thing. You know, we do these metal festivals like Hellfest and Grass Pop and all this stuff. And I overheard Nicky and Alice talking about it. And Nicky goes, man, they don't like us on these festivals. And Alice goes, well, we're grandfathered in. They like us because they give respect to where it all came from.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's been the very, very cool thing. And the Motley guys have been really, really a joy to tour with. I have a great tour prank idea for the end of the tour, actually, that I'm not going to say, but hopefully the guys will go along with it because I think it's an amazing idea. Everyone goes, no, don't prank Motley Crue because it's their last tour. I think you have to prank them because it's their last tour. It's tradition. Support band has to prank the headliner. Last tour or no last tour. The tour prank is a tradition that should never die, ever.
Well, thanks a lot, Nina. Thanks for coming on. I know it took a while to get this done. I stalked you and Josh at Grass Pop. I was never able to find you guys.
You know what? We were only there for just it was like a drive-in, drive-out for us.
Yeah, I figured that much because it was like, wow, it's like 2 hours till showtime and not one person from their camp is here.
Yeah.
So I figured it was an in-and-out thing.
Yeah, drive-in, drive-out. We rarely get there. I think we usually arrive about 2-3 hours before stage time.
Well, I was stalking you guys out in catering. I figured, well, even if they're coming in late, they got
to
eat.
They have to eat, exactly.
Right, but now I'm glad we did it here in Toronto.
I'm so glad too. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.